So we are up to the 8th, 9th, 10th, 11th, I don't know what number it is anymore, but I guess the 5th in a series of midrashim regarding the construction of the teva, the boat that Noah uses. And I'm not going to ask who saw the movie already, who didn't see the movie already. I've read so many reviews that I feel like I've sat through the movie. After another couple of reviews, I'm going to feel like I directed it. But the most accurate view that I've seen based on these various reviews is that it really relies heavily on a book called the Book of Enoch, which is not one of ours. It's some kind of a proto-Christian sect or something. And it relies heavily on that within the story. And that part of it, you know, as far as I'm concerned, isn't valid. On the other hand, I've also read that they make Noah a much darker figure than people usually think of him as, certainly than Christians are used to thinking of him as, but it's very consistent with what we've seen. We've talked about different aspects of Noah in the first series of Midrashim. We dealt with Noah's identification as righteous in his generation, and so on. And understanding Noah became very difficult in terms of just who he is and what he experiences. We haven't even gotten to the Midrashim about the actual flood. We're still building the boat. We've been building the boat all year long. It took him 120 years. I think we're right on track. But
the question is, did he pitch on both sides?
Right. In the movie, did he line it inside and out? That's a good question. Someone's going to have to study that in the film. Okay. But today, we're looking at, and this is the sheet that you hopefully have from last time. I did not bring additional copies this week. As I pledged in my email, I would not. This is a medrash that looks at Hashem's instruction to Noah regarding the dimensions of the boat, in which the Torah takes the time to tell me what the dimensions are of the boat. We've already seen a series of midrashim on the building of the boat, but now we're up to the dimensions of it. And by way of background to understand what the medrash is going to do here, we have to look at some verses first, which I brought on the sheets for those who have them. Do you have one from last time within the group of three? All right, we need to make sure. If someone could just share their sheet for this and look on with somebody else, because you can't have people sitting in a row without a sheet.
Oh, thank you. That's very nice.
Thank you very much.
What?
If you take a look at source number one, it's from Tehillim. And David HaMelech, King David, says, "B'fikudecha asicha ve'abita orchosecha." He's addressing God. And he says, in your commands, I speak casually, and I look upon your paths. It's the sheet that says 3111b, the lighter side of Torah at the top. So King David says, in your commands, I speak casually, and I look upon your paths. B'chukosecha eshtasha lo eshkach divarecha. In your statutes, God, I delight. I will not forget your words. It's a very, very odd sequence of sentences that King David uses regarding Torah, regarding the laws and messages of God. What's wrong with this passage? What doesn't work here? Why am I bothered by this, by source number one?
What's casually?
Ah, so Ralph asks what the Hebrew is for I speak casually. The word is asicha. Right? Asicha. The word asicha is usually, correct, siach is usually understood as conversation and often as light conversation, sort of chatter. For example, if you take a look at source number two is from the book of Malachim Aleph, Kings 1, when the Navi, the prophet Eliyahu, is mocking the prophets of the Baal when they have their showdown on Mount Carmel, and they're going to see which one is answered by God. Yes?
We pondered at source number six and said,
Oh, because you have, right, because you're using it from last week.
Yes.
And I, right, because last week I had come prepared to do two midrashim, and so I numbered them that way. You are right. It's the top source on the page, but it will not say, that's, you're good. You're good. Don't worry about the numbers. So there, Eliyahu mocks the prophets of the Baal as they're trying to summon fire to come down and consume their offering. And among the things he says to them is, maybe you should talk louder, because maybe your God doesn't hear you. And part of what he says is what I quoted you here in source number two. Maybe he's conversing with somebody, and that's why he's not hearing you and sending a fire to consume your offering. Or maybe he's being pursued by somebody, and therefore he's running away, and that's why he's not sending a fire to consume your offering. And he goes on, he says, maybe your God is using the washroom, and so on. Eliyahu was mocking the prophets of the Baal, and he uses the word kisiach to refer to conversation. Now, the truth of the matter is that siach could be taken as other types of speech. So, for example, we say within Kedusha, the part of the liturgy that talks about the angels praising God, can noam siach sod, or sod siach, depending on whether you're Ashkenazi or Sephardi, sarfei kodesh, we talk about the speech of the angels, and we use the term siach there. So it's possible to take the word siach as a more serious term. But as we'll see, the sages look at this and say that King David is saying that he speaks casually about God's commands. And he turns to God and he says, yeah, I sort of chatter with people about your commands. It's a very odd turn of phrase, Ralph.
But the word is not commands. The word is the pikud.
Right. What is it?
Which is amount. Or...
Mm. You are right that lifkod can be to count. However, the term here is like a pikuda. Like a mifakade in the army. A mifakade is an officer. A pikuda is a command. Yeah. The two words are related etymologically, but we're going to stick with this for now. He says, I speak casually of your commands, God. I look upon your paths. Bechukosecha, continuing still in source number one or source number six, depending on how you want to count them. Bechukosecha eshtasha. He says, in your statutes, God, I delight. That's an odd thing to say also. I mean, it's good to enjoy Torah. But to use that, you know, Torah is usually approached in this very sober way. What do you mean, in your statutes, I delight? So King David is using some very interesting phrases. When I used the translation of delight, I brought you an example of it in the third source, or number eight, for those who are keeping score on different sheets. Vishiasha yonek al chur pasen. This is a prediction from the famous chapter of Isaiah 11, which describes what will happen in a messianic time. So he says, a nursling will play on the hole of the asp, right? The place where the snake goes into its lair. And the term is to play, and the term is vishiasha. So what you're seeing is King David using some very informal language to describe his relationship with Torah. And our Medrash is going to take advantage of that and use it as an approach to the verses that are in the fourth source. And this finally brings us to Noach. Look at what God says to Noach. We've already read chapter 6, sentence 14 in Bereshit, in Genesis. Aseh lecha tevas atse gopher, kinim taaseh as hateva. Make for yourself a boat of gopher wood. Nests you shall make upon the boat, like we talked about, the use of the term nests as opposed to rooms or residences. V'chafarta osami bayis umichutz bakopher. You shall line it inside and outside with pitch. And we talked about lining it inside and outside as opposed to just outside and what material he uses. That was already last time. Two weeks ago, I should say. And then he says in sentence 15, and this is how you shall make it. And we talked about the and last time. And this is how you shall make it. Shlosh me'os hama orech hateva. This teva, this boat, should be 300 amma long. An amma, as we said last time, is a cubit, which explains everything I know. It's about 21.6 inches by popular measurement today. So 300 of them is the length of the boat. If you want to calculate out in centimeters, it just means really long. Chamishim amma rochba, 50 amma wide. Ushloshim amma komasa, and 30 amma tall. So the sages of the Medrash, with their ear for language, want to know, what do you need to tell me this for? Do I need to know the dimensions of the boat? God is not telling us everything in his conversation with Noah. That is taken as a given as we approach this. So whatever is here in the Torah is recorded because somehow it's relevant for me. If, as God is going to pledge further along in the story, there's never going to be another flood, just how useful is it for me to know the dimensions of the boat? Right?
You want a bigger one.
In case I want to say, I built Ark 2. Ark 2.0. So I need to know how big Ark 1.0 was. And therefore I'm going to make Ark 2.0. Come on. I need some rationale for needing this information in order to justify the Torah putting it in here. You know, FYI, 300 Amah long. Oh, okay, I'll make a note of that. Well, what's this doing here? Why is it here? So what we're going to do in the Medrash is we're going to combine the way that King David talks about Torah, this very light way that we saw in the first two sources, with this information that we're given about the dimensions of the boat, in order to inform us. Somehow this is going to give us a lesson. And so take a look now, please, at the fifth source on the page, which is our Medrash. And it says the following. Shlosh me'os amach orech hateva. The boat is 300 amah, 300 cubits long. Chamishim amah rochba, 50 amah, 50 cubits wide. Ushloshim amah komasa, and 30 cubits tall. And that we already knew because we saw that in source number 4. And here we go. Barchitaya amar. Barchitaya is one of the sages. We've actually seen Barchitaya quoted before in a medrash. And Barchitaya says the following. He quotes the verse that we saw at the start of the class. Befikudecha asicha bechukosecha eshtasha. The verses that say that King David says, I'm going to speak of your commands, God, in a casual way. I'm going to delight in your statutes. And the medrash says, limdascha Torah derech eretz. What does Derech Eretz mean?
Doing the right thing.
So colloquially, we tend to translate it as respect. I think the way that Sharon said it is sort of the usual approach to Derech Eretz. Derech Eretz, literally, the way of the land. Normal human behavior. Which we'd like to hope is respectful. But but it means just the way human beings are supposed to behave. That's Derech Eretz. So he says, the Torah here is teaching you the way of the land. Not in the sense of teaching us respect, but in the sense of teaching us human conduct, the way people behave. What is the Torah teaching me about how human beings behave? Take a look. It's going to tell us, Shemyasa adam sfina shete omedes bilamin. If one wants to make a boat that's going to stand by the sea, Yasa rochba echad mishisha be'orka ve'gavha echad me'asara be'orka. You should make sure that the width is 1/6 of the height and the height is 1/10 of its length. In other words, this is your biblical guide to building a boat. That's what the Medrash tells me. Why do I need to know the dimensions of this boat? Because I might want to build a boat. Basically what you said. Well, you said I want to build a bigger one. Even if I don't. If I want to build a good boat, then I guess I should follow the manual. And in the manual it says that I may not need the size of Noah's boat, but the ratio is here for me. Yes?
That's the template for building a boat.
This is the template for building a boat. How odd is that? Well, there are a couple of more points. First of all, what they're really trying to say here, and the point of this medrash, is to look at what King David is saying when he says, I will speak casually in your statutes. I am going to delight, right, in your statutes. The
That's
point
what
is,
God's doing, yeah.
So what they're trying to suggest here is that Torah is not all about my relationship with God. Torah is not all about deep spiritual lessons. Sometimes it's a guide for the most prosaic details of getting by in this world. Like how to build a boat. And And so, Barchi Taya assumes, as I said a few minutes ago, that there's a lot in the dialogue between God and Noah that isn't written in the text. And you want to go to the movie theaters and see what they think it was, that's fine. But whatever is in the text is meant to teach me something. Some of it's going to be deep religious lessons. And we've seen those. We spent all year on those. And some of them are going to be, so this is how you build a boat. This is the ratio you should have, length to width to height of the boat. That's the idea that Bar Chitaya sees in this account. It's really a remarkable idea it's a remarkable idea on two levels. Number one, it's remarkable to think that they're expecting to give us instructions about how to build a boat. Keep in mind that we spent our first 40 years wandering in a desert. Like, Moses, what do we do with the boat instructions? Don't worry, eventually. That's number one. But number two, this is something we have to really look at in terms of what it tells us about Torah at large. Not only the issue of, the Israelite Navy, but in general, how I'm supposed to look at biblical text. Let's start, though, in terms of the boating experience, because, frankly, it's not so clear that this is good naval advice. It's an interesting piece of advice, but it's not necessarily a good idea. Take a look at the sixth source that I brought you on the sheet. And again, for those who came in later, you won't see this sheet out here this week. It was emailed out and it was printed last week, so you may need to look on with somebody else. But this comes from a Wikipedia article. I looked at numerous articles on boating and boat construction in order to prepare for this, but the Wikipedia one actually had a good digest here. And what they talk about is what's called the length to beam ratio. Okay? Length, you understand, front of the boat to the back of the boat, beam is perpendicular to that. So if you're imagining that the boat is pointing north-south, generally a bad idea, but if you imagine that the boat is pointing north-south, then beam is east-west. So there's a certain ratio called the length to beam ratio that you want to achieve. And what they say is typical length to beam ratios for small sailboats are from 2-to-1 if you're dealing with dinghies, trailerable sailboats around 20 feet long, to 5-to-1 for racing sailboats, right? And think about that. That's logical, right? Think about the aerodynamics of a car and realize you have the hydrodynamics of the boat. You need to make sure if you want a racing boat and your boat is this wide compared to only this long, you ain't getting anywhere, right? You need to make sure you have far more length than you do width. On the other hand, in terms of stability, right? And Noah's boat isn't built to go anywhere. It's just built to float. So therefore, you have greater concern for stability. So then, you don't want your ratio to be, you don't want to have a high ratio where you have way more length than you have width. So he says here, large ships have widely varying beam ratios, some as large as 20-to-1, right? Think of like an aircraft carrier, right, which is way longer than it is wide. Rowing shells designed for flat water racing may have length to beam ratios as high as 30-to-1, because it's just a racing shell. That's all it's supposed to do is speed. While a caracal, right, caracals were actually much more common in Greek times, those were round. So they say here, has a ratio of almost 1-to-1, it is nearly circular. Those were designed much more to float downstream. So, keeping all of that in mind, this boat that Noah is building has a ratio of what length to beam?
5-to-1.
Has a ratio of what length to beam? We're going to call our math people here.
6-to-1.
The ratio is 6-to-1. So that's more like a floating ratio, or is it more like a let's make this boat move ratio? Well, it depends on what you're going to compare it to, really. Meaning, if you're comparing it to the racing shell, it's obviously not a racing shell. Racing shell is 30-to-1, right? Or at least some of them are. On the other hand, you have racing sailboats that are at 5-to-1. It's not a caracal. The bottom line is that your advice on how to build a boat really depends on what kind of boat you want to build. And this may be good advice in certain circumstances and terrible advice in other circumstances. You have to use this wisely. There are actually many ship hobbyists who have websites where they discuss the engineering ramifications of a 6-to-1 length to beam ratio. The skeptics love this, meaning this is their big challenge to the story of Noah's Ark. Would this boat have floated for a year? To which I just look at them and say, like, that's what bothers you? The elephants don't bother you? this is your issue. The rain for, 40 days of rain, flooding the planet. Like, no, our problem is would the boat float or not. Ultimately, in order to evaluate whether this boat would have floated or not, there are two pieces of information that you need that we don't get. Number one, weight of the cargo, right, which matters. And number two, distribution of the cargo, right? Because it really depends on where they are on the boat.
In their nests,
thank you. The elephant in the elephant's nest. Are they on the upper floor? Are they on the lower floor? Is it equally distributed? I don't know. I haven't seen the movie. So really, this is not enough information for us to use this in any meaningful way. Right? Bar Chitaya, he can't possibly mean that if you look in the book of, this reminds me of a great joke that I once heard that I have to tell you. And for some of you, this will go like by completely, and some of you, this will really resonate with. It was from Rabbi Philip Kaplan, Olav HaShalom, in Rhode Island, my first shul, right before Sukkot. He said, he told me the story of the guy in yeshiva who wanted to build a sukkah, right? Sukkot is coming. He wants to build the proper hut. And so he goes to his rabbi and he says, Rabbi, I want to build a sukkah. I just got married. My wife and I want to have our own sukkah. So how do I do this? And he points to a page in the Talmud in the volume called Sukkah. And he says, look at Rashi over there in his commentary. He gives you all the instructions. So the yeshiva guy sits down. He studies the Rashi carefully. He goes out to Home Depot. He gets his equipment. He tries to build the sukkah. First wind comes, smash, the whole thing collapses. I must have read it wrong. So he goes back, he studies it again, and he goes back and he builds it again, and sure enough, the wind comes, knocks down the sukkah. I don't know what I'm doing wrong. He goes back to his Rebbe, and he says, Rebbe, I followed it to the letter. I did this, and then this, and then this, and the wind came, and it knocked it down. Rebbe looks at him and says, yeah, Tosfos asks that question. Tosfos is the standard foil for Rashi on the Talmud. When Rashi says something, it's the job of the Tosafists to disagree. So my point in bringing that is only because if you try to build your boat based on this little piece of information that Rashi Taya has identified for us, you will end up with that kind of sukkah. Except that when the sukkah hit the ground, the boat's going further down. What Bar Chitaya can't mean that this is your guide to boat building. It's just not reasonable. Particularly when you realize that he lives in an environment in Israel in which people are voting. We find the sages all the time going back and forth between where the Jews are and other lands, particularly going to Rome to deal with the Roman authorities. It's not as though he's unfamiliar with boat building and thinks that, okay, all you need are these dimensions and now you're good to go. It's just not a reasonable reading of the Medrash. Bar Chitaya is trying to make a different point. And the point that he's trying to make is that there will be times when we are going to get practical guidance and things from the Torah. Just like over here, we are being told the dimensions of Noah's boat. It can't be the be-all and end-all. You're going to have to study other things if you want to build a boat. But the Torah is interested in the practical details of how you live your life as well. There's more here than my relationship with God, although that's plenty. There also has to be an understanding of what my relation, how I'm going to function in this world. And I want to take that idea a little bit further. The idea of the Torah giving us practical instructions for life doesn't just show up here. It shows up in other cases. I brought you, for example, source number 7. This is a piece of advice for how you get along in society. And it deals with, it's not number 7 on your sheets. It's number 7 on my sheet. It's the 7th source on your sheet. Long story. Not going through that again. But it revolves around a practice called shushvin. Okay? In modern Hebrew, what are shushvinin? Do they use the term? Yeah. Not a shadchan. That's different. A shushvin.
Shushmin, is, I think in contemporary use, means a close friend. That's my understanding. But in Talmudic times, it actually was a technical term. And what would happen is, there would, you'd have a circle of friends who were so close that they would all be invited to each other's weddings and to celebrate the week after the wedding together. And they would all bring gifts. And being part of the Shushvin circle, the circle of close friends, meant that you were required to bring a gift. And they were required to bring a gift for you. So it was this sort of reciprocal thing where everybody would get, it's like the class gift when you have kids in day school, right? So, you know, everyone will just arrange, everyone will take care of bringing the gift for the other, and that's the, it's the gift pool, sort of. So that was the practice of Shushvinin, these close friends, and it was really, like, it was a real, almost contractual relationship, so that if someone failed to reciprocate, like, they could be brought to court. It was a very serious issue. So, keeping that in mind, take a look at source number 7, where the Talmud talks about the creation of Chava, the creation of Eve. And the Torah says, Vayivieha el ha'adam, that when God creates Eve, he then brings her to meet the man, Adam. Amar Rabbi Yirmiyah ben Elazar, Rabbi Yirmiyah ben Elazar said, Milameid shenasa HaKadosh Baruch Hu shushvin la'adam harishon. God acts as a shushvin for Adam. Not in the sense that it's going to be reciprocal, God isn't getting married in this religion, but in the sense that God is helping Adam, different story. God is helping Adam at his wedding. He is helping move things along. He brings the bride to the groom. Now, God ranks fairly high in this universe. And so, what the Talmud says is, Mikan limda Torah derech eretz. Here the Torah taught us, once again that phrase, derech eretz, the way of the land, how human society should conduct itself. Sheyachzor gadol im katan b'shushvinus va'al yeralo. That the great should be a shushvin for the lesser. You shouldn't think that it's inappropriate somehow for someone of my stature. I am going to go entertain him at his wedding. Don't focus on your own stature. If God can go celebrate with Adam and Eve, with Adam and Chava, it's not beneath you to go celebrate with somebody at their wedding and to help them rejoice and so on. So, I'm not going into the discussion about weddings. That wasn't the point. The point is that the sages see the Torah as a manual not only for how the human being relates to God, but how the human being relates to other human beings.
But Derech Eretz is very different from the way we translate it. More so in this case, but in the case of a boat, it's...
But that's exactly the point. It's one and the same. In other words, all of these are how human beings function, and it's almost as if to say, although maybe I'm overstating it a little bit, but it's almost as if to say that you should view the laws of your relationship with others as just as immutable and just as inherent in nature as the laws of mathematics, the laws of physics. Just like I wouldn't dream of, you know, pretending that gravity no longer exists and dropping a valuable thing over a stone floor, so too I shouldn't dream of treating somebody with disrespect. It's like it's the law of gravity in terms of human beings. That would be, I think, and maybe I'm overstating it a hair, but I'm not even sure that it is overstating it. Rita.
So, is it like saying we're all equal in the eyes of God, and we should treat each other that way, and there shouldn't be this arrogance because of my position, I'm better than you? Is that the lesson?
Well, I would go even further. I would say that it's not there should be no spiritual overtone to this particular lesson. This is just the way human beings are supposed to relate, irrespective of God. In other words, just I should, regardless of my personal standing, when it comes to, in this case, helping someone celebrate the joy of their wedding, it's not about me. It's not about my standing. It's about what I can do for them. I think that's the way to look at it. Take a look at the next source where I also bring you this. There's a lot more yet to see today. I was hoping to get to gemology today, but we'll see if we get there. The last source that I brought on this sheet, the Medrash on Shir HaShirim Rabbah, on the book Song of Songs, gives us another example. The verse in Shir HaShirim and Song of Songs describes King Solomon declaring, "The beams of our home are cedar, our ornaments are cypress." That's a statement. That's the statement that's in Song of Songs. So Amar Rabbi Yochanan said, Limda Torah Derech Eretz, the Torah teaches you the way of the land. That you should use cedar for the beams and you should decorate with cypress. Don't mix up the two. Don't use cypress for the beams and cedar for the decorations. That's it. It is not a lesson about how I relate to somebody else. It is not a lesson of respect. It is simply a practical bit of guidance when you're choosing the wood to use. Cedar is better for you to use for ceiling beams. Cypress is good for ornamentation. Now, I did not look into the carpentry aspects of this. Gut instinct says that cedar is a better wood for it because that's what people use for beams. People don't use cypress for it. But if anyone has carpentry background and wants to weigh in, no? Okay. Then in that case, I'm just going to say I'm right. That's what we're being told here. And there's all sorts of practical advice that comes with this quote. And that's what we're getting in part. Now, the truth of the matter is that there's another way to look at this. There are plenty of books out there that try to provide practical guidance based on the Bible. So like leadership advice from Moses, that type of thing. And those have their place. But keep in mind what we started with in this Medrash. The Medrash took the first source on this side and had King David saying, in your commands I speak casually. Right? I delight in this sort of thing. Which was a lighter way to look at it. Which is to say, those aspects of Torah that teach me Derech Eretz, whether Derech Eretz is carpentry or how my boat should be built or whatever it is, those parts are lighter than the rest. They're there, but it's what he talks about in terms of something more casual. What carries the real weight to him? The real weight is in the part that's about his relationship with God. The part that's not about how I'm going to build my house or how I'm going to build my boat, but the part that's going to be how I relate to my Creator. That is where it is where the basic substance is. I may also learn how to get by in this world, but the ikar, the essence, is my relationship with God. That's what I'm pulling from this medrash. So to summarize what this medrash has done, number one, the ear. Again, the ear that the sages have for the biblical text says there's something odd about including the dimensions. The dimensions must be here for some purpose. Their method of approaching it is not like we've seen in other cases. In other cases, we've seen them, draw on a textual anomaly here, something else there. Here, their method is really simple logical deduction to say, well, it must be that it's meant to teach me a practical lesson, from which I understand that the Torah does that. It teaches me practical lessons. And the moral of the story is that the Torah will teach me how to get by in this world, even though that's not the essential point of having a Torah. Even though it's not what the Torah is mostly here for, it is something that the Torah will provide. Clear?
Where else are they also on the ancient, building, not the pavement?
So they are mentioned in the Beit HaMikdash in the Temple. That was last week when we talked about that. It's in the Mishkan, when they build the traveling temple that they have in the wilderness. So you see the Amma there. A couple of times in the Torah when they talk about the person's height, like, oh, king of Bashan. So we are told that their measurements in Amot. So actually, it's really Og's bed, actually, that we're given the dimensions for in Amot. So
they come up. How do they measure the acreage that the tribes are to occupy?
So we don't get that. We only get the boundaries based on geographical markers. We don't actually get it in Amma numbers. Nothing that specific. It's too bad because it would have been helpful. But we don't have that. Okay, Rita and then
Marilyn. I'm a little confused.
Mission accomplished.
How to get in... you said it's not how to get... to live in this world is not as important as our relationship with God.
living in this world is hugely important, but the Torah gives when the Torah presents advice on carpentry or on boats or whatever this is, how to get by in this world, that is considered to be the lighter side of Torah, the heavier side being the description of my spiritual relationship with God.
Okay, now, how does that relate to the Shishon, like dealing with other people?
The Shush. So it appears, you're right, it appears you could make the argument that that's part of what's called the lighter side. Not in the sense that it's not significant, but that it's not the major mission of the Torah. That could be argued. It could also be argued, though, that there are two different kinds of derech eretz. I didn't do that here. I conflated everything together. But I'm not sure that I'm right for doing so. I'm not sure.
So the most important thing is our relationship.
In terms of what the Torah wants to convey and what it's here for, the heaviest part seems to be that. That's the way I would put it. Yes, Marilyn.
Are there any other Mefarshim that comment on this particular thing about why the dimensions are included? I mean, this is one midrash that we're extrapolating from, but are there other ideas and why it's there?
I did not find any.
Really?
I went looking a little bit because I wanted to see if anybody quoted this medrash and did anything with it. Because really, this was a hard medrash to work with. There isn't much here.
But not even
the pasuk itself.
Are there any other commentaries on that particular pasuk?
Right. So when I went looking to see if anybody quoted this, I looked through the commentaries and no one tackles the question of what these dimensions are doing here. Yeah. Out of luck.
I'm curious.
No, it's a good question, but unfortunately, that's the answer.
Also, it's a statement in itself.
Yes.
The other areas where there's so much expanded upon, and here, so that we might lead to deduce from that, and some people just went.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. I think there was a lot of shrugging.
They're not taking a larger message.
Yeah, and when you get to the mystics, they love things like this. And I will guarantee you, without having looked, that if I were to look through the more mystical works on this, yeah, they would be able to talk about the ratios and the dimensions and say the 300 symbolizes this and the 50 symbolizes that. They'll go to town on this kind of thing. This is bread and butter. But outside of them, no, I haven't seen it. There's kind of a collective shrug of, okay, interesting dimensions, let's move on, you know, type of an approach. I don't think it's because they disagree with Bar Chitaya's basic premise, which is that God only puts things in from his conversation with Noah if he wants us to get something. It's just that they don't see anything to get from it. I think that's where it's coming from. Okay, so that was all the first medrash for today. Now we get to the second medrash for today.